taping it here. There are exceptions. Somebody called me just before class. And he wanted to know if he could do business. Is he a good guy to run this deal by to see if we can invest together in a company? Called me. I don't get a lot of calls like that, by the way. I don't usually give out a lot of business advice. I'm not sure why. He just knew I knew the guy. And unfortunately, I've been involved in a situation with this gentleman where he had been involved in a form of theft, a serious form of theft. Am I supposed to say something or not? Guy wants to invest. He wants to do some business. Yes or no? What do you think? Class participation. Why? Why is this different? It's true. Okay, fine. But it's still going to hurt the guy. He's going to lose out the business, and I'm going to worsen his reputation. Because if I fail to speak, what else does it say in that verse that you read before? You shall not go about as a talebearer. You shall not stand by the blood of your neighbor. What does that teach? What does that mean, stand by the blood? Is that literally, and just figuratively, only refer to literally standing by the blood of someone else? By the way, it does refer to that. If you're a doctor, and you walk by somebody, and they're in, God forbid, in a pool of blood, you can save them. Or you are an advanced swimmer, and someone's drowning in the pool, and you just keep going, you listen to their pleas, and their cries for help, and you just keep walking. Again, is there a responsibility in law to jump in and save the person? When is there a responsibility according to the law, secular law, to save the person, Sergeant? When you have a duty. When you have a fiduciary duty, what would give you a fiduciary duty? Good. So if you were being paid to watch people, and you're just like, you turn over, get sun over here, you know.
Or if you started to help.
Right. So because, by the way, it's interesting as an aside, because there's no obligation for you to help, and because we live in such a litigious society, doctors stopping from helping because they would get involved. They had no requirement to help. They took a Hippocratic oath to heal. But like, that's in the office. Here, I can get sued if I do something wrong. And I have no obligation. So that's why certain states in this country enacted what's called Good Samaritan laws to protect doctors when they help other people in case they're negligent. They are protected against lawsuits in a case of negligence as long as they're not grossly negligent. You still can't be grossly negligent. And those Good Samaritan laws will otherwise, they'll protect you. But they're not in every state. In Jewish tradition, because of this verse, if you have the ability to save someone and you walk by, you are in violation of the crime of omission. And I would argue, getting back to our conversation about conversations and gossip, that if somebody calls you up and asks you, should I do business with them? And you have first-hand knowledge, that this person cheated or stole, then you have an obligation to say something. And because, not necessarily al tamad al dam reacha, not stand by thy brother's blood, but there's another verse in the Torah. Lo siten, before a blind man thou shalt not place a stumbling block. You're literally not supposed to put a stumbling block in front of someone's blind, but what does it mean before a blind person, don't place a stumbling block? This person about to enter into a business deal is blind. He or she is blind to the person that they're about to get into a deal with. And you, by not disclosing what you know, are allowing that person to literally walk into a wall. And we have a responsibility. What's the common refrain here? It's not enough simply to take care of ourselves. We have a fiduciary responsibility to our fellow human being. And that's why it's not enough that it's true. And that's what we always say, but it's true. I know it's true. But guess what? If you share it, and you don't need to share because you're not going into business with them, or there isn't some other very compelling reason, you are only adding to the pain of another human being. And it's not for us to determine, well, he's a jerk, he deserves for us to badmouth him. If we took that attitude, we would be living in a very, very harsh world. And unfortunately, the world is quite harsh because we don't have these kinds of traditions. But we're here to talk about the Jewish concept of speech. And the Jewish concept of speech is pretty rigid, as you can hear. We're not permitted to say anything negative about another fellow Jew. And I would argue we should try to do this for everyone. But technically, the prohibition applies to a fellow Jew. To not to speak ill of that individual either. Certainly not negative things. And certainly not things which cast a negative light on the person. Or on true things, of course. But even if they're true, and even if they're not negative. Now I want to go back to this. What is wrong with saying something that's true and not negative? Did you hear so-and-so redid their kitchen? They must have put $100,000 into that kitchen. Wow. What's wrong with that? Causes the other person, play it out.
So the other person can say, oh wow, she just, I don't know, she didn't say anything. Oh, she spent it on that. And
yeah, very good. You know, I had a birthday. You see the cheap thing she bought me for my birthday? And she said she has no money. She obviously has a lot of money put into the kitchen. It brings up all other sorts of ideas. Yes?
Speculation based on price. So just because someone has a new kitchen, but then you are you know, inserting a
right.
Contractors and then
good. So both of you are saying, in other words, it can and it often does lead to other truly negative things. But what is wrong with the thing itself?
Because you can make someone feel bad. If they can't, like let's say for example the person says, well, oh I just spent $100,000 on my kitchen. Let's say the other person can't spend $100,000. She might feel uncomfortable.
Also, and we're also talking about one last thing I want to share, and that's confidences. We have to try to get into the practice of not speaking about other people and their stuff. And there's a tremendous yetzer hara, there's a tremendous drive and inclination to this because it makes us feel great. And what I want to do is share with you a story from the Torah itself that illustrates Judaism's take. Why is it so hard to refrain from this? Why is so much of our life revolving around other people's stuff and information? And, you know, the elections also was just, why is the media, and why was this such a major, I really believe that the country was not simply up in arms about two candidates that were not as popular or as likable. Okay, we spoke about this last week. But we have just gotten to a place where we are so in each other's faces and lives. And it's distracting us from really what we're supposed to be doing and building up ourselves. Listen to the story, and you might be familiar with it. The story takes place later on in the Bible, in the Torah. And it takes place between two of the greatest personalities in the Torah. Three, actually. Moshe, his sister Miriam, and his brother Aaron. I'm going to read it to you, we're going to talk about it a little, and hopefully develop a deeper understanding as to why the Torah wants us to be so careful about what we say about each other. Vatedaber Miriam v'Aaron b'Moshe, and Miriam, that's Moses' sister, and Aaron, his brother, were speaking about Moshe, Al Odot HaIsha HaKushit Asher Lakach, in regard to the Kushite woman that he had taken, Ki Isha Kushit Lakach, because Moses had married a woman from Kush, which, according to some of the commentaries, was Ethiopia. at the time. It's probably the area of the world where she was from. Vayomru, when they said, Harak ach b'Moshe diber Hashem, was it only with Moses that God spoke? Halo gam banu diber? Didn't God also speak with us? Vayishma Hashem. And God heard. Which is kind of strange. God heard. God hears everything. Why does the Torah have to tell us? God was listening in on their conversation. God paid attention. Vayish Moshe Nav Me'od. The next verse reads, and Moses, the man Moses, was very humble. Mikol Adam Asher Pnei Adama. Now what does that have to do with the story? Starting to get a little juicy. Aaron and Miriam are starting to talk about their brother Moshe, who marries this Cushite woman. And then God listens, and Moses is humble. What does Moses' humility have to do with it? What's it doing here? Vayomer Hashem, and God said, Pitom, suddenly. God said suddenly? Suddenly God appeared to Moshe and Aaron, the El Miriam, to the three of them. Tzeush Shloshchem El Ol Moed. He said, all three of you, go out to the tent of meeting. The tent of meeting is where God would communicate primarily with Moshe. And God is calling them to the tent of meeting. Vayetzu shloshtam, and all three of them, of course, obey God's command, and they go into the tent of meeting. Vayera Hashem b'amud anan, and then it says the next verse, and God descended into in the guise of a cloud. You know, God would represent himself in the wilderness, in the 40-year wilderness sojourn as in a cloud. And God descended in a cloud by Amot Petachol, and God stood, so to speak, in this cloud outside of the tent. Vayikra Aaron u'Miriam, and God called to Aaron and to Miriam. Vayetzu shneihem, and the two of them walked out of the tent outside to talk to God. Vayomer, and God said, Shimon Advarai, listen to my words. Im yiyeh neviyachem Hashem b'mareh, a love. If I ever would speak to you, if there would be prophets, someone who hears the revelation, in a vision would I make myself known. Bachalom, in a dream would I speak. Lochein avdi Moshe, but not so with Moses, my servant. Bechol beitin emanhu, in my entire house, he is the most trusted. Pe el pada berbo, him I speak face to face, mouth to mouth. You speak directly. Umar'eh, velo b'chidut t'tmonat Hashem, and not in any, in a mar'eh means a clear vision, and not in riddles, or not in any kind of dream state. Umadu'a lo yiretim l'daber b'abdi Moshe, and therefore why did you not fear to speak this way about my servant Moses? Vayichav Hashem, and God gets angry. Bam with them, vayilech, and he leaves. Ve'anan sar me'al ha'oel, and then the cloud, God's cloud of glory, removes itself from the tent. V'hinei Miriam mitzarat kasheleg, and Miriam now is white like a leper. She's stricken with leprosy. Vayifen Aaron el Miriam, and Aaron turns to Miriam. V'hinei mitzarat, and behold, she has become mitzarat, stricken with leprosy. Vayomer Aaron el Moshe. Aaron then said to his brother Moshe, Be Adoni, please, my master, Al not tashet alinu chatan, please do not hold any sin against us. Hashanu anu v'asher chatanu, Al not tihi kamet, asher b'tzeito mirecha mimo, ve'achel chatzi v'saro. Let her not be like a corpse, speaking about Miriam, like one who leaves his mother's womb with half his flesh having been consumed. Vayitzak Moshe el Hashem lemor, and God, and Moses spoke to God, calls out, he cries out to God, and he says, Kel na, please, Rifana la, please God, please heal her. And that's it. The rest of it tells us that the entire camp waited for Miriam to heal from her leprosy. And the sages teach that they all waited because Miriam, when Moshe was a little boy, was in the basket floating in the Nile, and she watched over him to make sure he was okay, and therefore the Jewish people waited the 7 days until finally Miriam could re-enter the camp. What is going on with this story? It's a very bizarre story. Having this conversation, first of all, what were they talking about? Were they really gossiping about Aaron and Miriam? Were gossiping about their brother, that he married a black woman, an Ethiopian woman? Was that it, really? And if that was the case, what kind of reaction is this from God? Why is God saying, why did they say, they seemed to be upset. Was it only with Moses that God spoke? Moses spoke to all of the Jewish people, referring to the giving of the Torah at Sinai. And then it says Moshe was very humble. And then it says that God came to them suddenly. And he pulls them out of the tent, and he says, how could you speak about Moshe this way? Don't you know I speak face to face with him? It's not like the way I speak to other prophets where they have to fall into a dream state. I talk to Moshe face to face. What's going on here? So this is really interesting. And there's a lot of Jewish philosophy and theology in here. Miriam and Aaron did not necessarily have negative intentions according to our sages. And this is where the sages come in to explain the story. What were they saying? They didn't understand, particularly Miriam, why Moshe and his wife Zipporah did not get back together after the giving of the Torah. All husbands and wives, Jewish couples, were told to separate in advance of the giving of the Torah. Anybody know how long? For 3 days. How did they know this? God told them. God said that husbands and wives should be intimate with each other. They should be physically separated for 3 days to prepare spiritually for the giving of the Torah. What happened after the Torah was given? Everybody got back together. Family, most important thing in Judaism. Except for one Jewish couple. Moshe and Zipporah did not get back together. And Miriam didn't understand why. And she asked, Harak ach b'Moshe diber Hashem? Was it only with Moses that God spoke? We all separated, but we all got back together. She didn't understand, why are they remaining apart? Why are they remaining apart? God explained. And this is certainly not the model, this is not the norm, but this was Moshe. Moshe and Zipporah needed to remain apart, and this explains why God appeared suddenly. Why is he appearing suddenly? He didn't give him any preparation. You're about to hear a prophetic vision from the Almighty. No. Bam. Talking to you right now. No preparation, because that's the way Moshe, that's the way Moses spoke with the Almighty. No one else did, we believe. In fact, the great Maimonides, Jewish philosopher, wrote that one of the 13 principles of Jewish faith is to believe not only that Moses, through Moses that the Torah was given, but that his level of nevuah, his level of prophecy, was qualitatively superior to all other prophets who had to fall into some kind of unconscious state of being in order to receive prophecy. Moshe would speak to God just like you and I are speaking to each other now. And for that he needed to be spiritually prepared at all times. He needed to be somewhat removed from the physical world and even marriage. And this was not the goal. This is not the norm. This is not something we're putting up Moshe so all of us should follow. This was something very, very unique to Moshe. And when Miriam and Aaron understood that Moses' level of prophecy was different and it necessitated a different lifestyle, then they understood. Rav Soloveitchik says something very, very powerful, one of the greatest rabbis of our generation. He says, what do we learn from this story? What is so awful and terrible about Lashon Hara? And what's happening here? Why is this the quintessential story in the whole Bible about slander? Seems like a weird thing. Miriam and Aaron weren't really saying anything bad about Moshe. By the way, was it true? Yeah, he was separated. Anything wrong with it? No. God was saying it's just a measure of his high prophetic level. So what was wrong? What was wrong? Why does Miriam get stricken with leprosy? Rav Soloveitchik explains very beautifully, because what does it truly mean to speak Lashon Hara about another person? It means you're taking something which is unique and special about another human being, and you are saying, you're not so special. You're not so unique. Harak ach b'Moshe diber Hashem? Was Moses the only one who spoke? We all spoke to God. We were all prophets. What was special and unique and distinct about Moses? His prophecy. His way of talking to God was different than any other prophet, even greater than Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And what Miriam was doing by saying that he should have remained married, I don't understand, and maybe she was even compelled by sympathy for her sister-in-law, Tzipora, who had to remain alone. She might have been motivated by something positive, but in the end of the day, she was taking away what was special about Moshe. That is Lashon Hara. We don't realize this when we do it, but when we speak ill about another person, ultimately what we're doing is we're trying to reduce them to our own level. We're trying to say, you think you're special, you think you're unique, you're distinct, you're not really, you're just like everybody else. And that's why it could be about something completely what seems like it's harmless. You know, when I was a kid, I was obsessed with the drums. From the age of 12, I rebelled against my parents. I wanted me to play piano, like every Jewish family, I guess. And I hated my piano teacher and my piano. I took lessons for 3 years, and I kept tapping on the keyboard. And I always had a pretty good rhythm, and I just drummed. By the time I was 14 or 15, I obsessed about it. I still am a little crazy about the whole thing. I love. And I was a decent ball player, but I didn't take it nearly as seriously as the drums. And if you had said to me, Wilds, you stink on the court. You can't hit a layup if your life depended on it. I'd be able to, as a teenager, when these things matter, I'd actually be able to move on. But if you called me a bad drummer, it would have been the end of me. I so define myself. Now, I probably shouldn't have, and we all shouldn't. But we do. We define ourselves often by the things that make us unique. What makes me different and stand out from other people? And then somebody pulls that away and just says, no, you're just like everybody else. That, says Rav Soloveitchik, explains why something as harmless as something which is not even negative, and it's not false, it could be 100% true, but it's what makes me feel like me. And you take that away from another person. It's devastating. It's devastating. Denying the uniqueness of another individual. And Soloveitchik drives the point home because juxtapositions in the Bible are always important. If anybody knows what takes place immediately after this story, this is the very last couple of verses I was reading from the parsha called Bahalotcha in the book of Numbers. The next parsha begins, Shlach, send the spies. And Rashi, the great biblical commentator, asks the question, why? Lama nismecha parshas Meraglim l'parshas Miriam? Why is the parsha of the spies juxtaposed to the parsha of Miriam? What does one thing have to do with the next? And listen to what Rashi says, l'fisha laksa al iske diba, because the spies who were sent into Israel to check out the land of Israel, they saw what happened to Miriam when she spoke ill of her brother Moshe, when she denied what was unique about him. And what did the spies do? They could have learned the lesson. Instead, they went into Israel. And what did they say about the land of Israel? They appraised it like any ordinary piece of real estate. They looked at it. If you look at their analysis, this is good about it, this is not so good, this could be okay, the giant, blah, 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 but back and forth. They just talked about it like it was any ordinary piece of land. They balanced debits against credits, this is Rav Soloveitchik's words, and they declared the entire enterprise hopeless. With grandeur facing them, all they could see was the mundane. And when you look at another person and all you see is blah and nothing special, Or maybe you see something special, but you can't handle it because he's your buddy. And you know, there's only one thing getting worse than getting a 75 or 65 on a test, and that is your good friend getting an 85. So you want to bring him down a notch. It makes us feel better. Now, why should it make me feel any better? If I did poorly on a test, why should it make me feel better that my friend did even worse? It shouldn't, but it's so woven into our defense mechanisms to look at ourselves in relation to other people. And that ultimately is, in a sense, indirectly somewhat of a denial of God Himself. Very strange passage in the Talmud. I never understood this. It says, a person who speaks lashon hara, it's as though they're denying the existence of God. It's like, really? It's not that bad. I mean, you're denying the existence of God. What's one thing have to do with the other? Because there's two ways to grow in life. Well, there's only really one way to grow in life. That's actually to get better. But there's an easier way to feel like you grew. And that is to make other people seem worse in relation to yourself. It's much simpler, actually. You don't have to go to school. You don't have to work hard. You can just badmouth other people, convince others they're not as great, and you feel better. But you're not any better. So why are you feeling better if you're not any better? Because we are looking at ourselves in relation to each other. Right? No one wants to admit we do that, but we do it all the time. That's why we get competitive. But if you think about it, competition, although it could be helpful in business, is just another way of saying that I'm evaluating myself not in relation to my potential. God made me like this, and I can go like that. I'm evaluating myself in relation to others. I'm comparing. And life is not a curve. Life's only about how far I get in relation to me. And when we get so wrapped up with other people, and we start feeling better when other people look worse, then we know we have gotten to a place where we're not progressing. We're just bringing other people down. And I have to say that this is, it's an industry. It's a billion-dollar industry in our society. And it's crept into politics, and it reared its ugly head like in no other election. You put anyone under a light, okay, there's going to be stuff. Everybody, all of us, none of us is perfect. The question is, are we trying to get better in relation to our potential? Or are we spending too much time looking at each other? And by the way, it doesn't make us feel, it's making us feel worse in the end. Not because we feel guilty we said something bad. No. We don't feel guilty anymore. Everybody's doing it. All the time. We're feeling bad because we're also looking at other people's successes, or we're checking other people's Facebook pages, and we love Facebook. And we're wondering, why don't I have that? How can I have that? And we're raising a whole generation. I spoke with a close friend of mine whose son has got like a terrible case of FOMO in 10th grade. And it's very hard for this young man to be happy because he always thinks he's missing something. And all he has to do is check one of his 5,000 friends on Facebook and lo and behold, he's missing something. Now, he's not really missing anything. He's missing that 2-second thing where he go, right? And imagines that he must, you know, life's just passing him by. Now, don't get me wrong, Facebook's unbelievable. It is. It's giving us the opportunity to spread this knowledge and this wisdom with so many more people than are sitting in this room. But we have to understand what's coming along with it. And Facebook can be an extraordinarily positive force in the world, and it is to a large degree. But it also could be used to drive ourselves crazy by imagining that someone else is doing better all the time. And we have to somehow prevent ourselves and just be a little more disciplined. And, you know, they say half the therapy is just awareness. So tonight is just awareness. It's making ourselves aware that we're thinking like this and that we're sucked into it probably more than we even think. And I'm not telling you not to go onto Facebook, because it's a great way to meet people, it's a great way to stay connected, it's a great way to learn things. But we have to stop imagining that someone else is doing it worse or better, and spend a little more time looking inside. how am I doing? And a little more time at this book. This is Torah. This book is great because it does tell us about other people. But the other people that it mentions are stories so we can learn lessons about how to live ourselves and not look around at what everyone else is saying or doing. And we've just gotten, I think, in the last 20, 30 years in our society, very, very far when it comes to this. And it's time, I think, to pull things back a little. It's time to give people the benefit of the doubt, to stop being so critical of others. And even if we feel judgmental of other people, let's keep it to ourselves. It hurts other people, and it is allowing a very artificial and false sense of growth. By allowing ourselves temporarily to feel better about us without actually getting better, just because we've knocked someone else down a notch, or we've effectively taken away what is special and unique about them. That's okay. We can really celebrate our differences, and we can celebrate what other people have that we don't have. We have to find what it is that's unique about us. And when you find that about your friend, you be really careful. When you find that unique, distinct feature that your friend has, maybe they shouldn't, and maybe I shouldn't have taken the drums as seriously and identify with it so closely. But we need to learn what that is about each other and be super, super sensitive about it. Because there's a lot hanging on that. And just because somebody is famous doesn't mean they don't have feelings. And they now deserve, oh, you decided to be famous, and therefore you are, you know, fair game. We can beat you up. What do you mean? You're famous. We can say anything we want about you, and we can print it, and we can spread it around. You know, that's you're going into politics, get used to it. Unfortunately, the only people who can handle that game, that's what's going to end up happening. We're going to narrow the people, the very quality people in this country that are going to allow themselves to be beaten up like this. And we're going to then wonder why we have the candidates we have. Who have the thick skin and the shell to be able to handle this kind of abuse. It's just gotten so out of hand. And as I mentioned last week, it's enabled us to use it as a form of entertainment, because who wants to sit there and talk about the actual policies and what will be better for America? It's a lot more fun to just personalize the whole thing. And so this is really, this is not just about politicians, this is about we conduct business, the way we conduct business in our professional lives. It's the way we date, when we date, just because it didn't work out or I got hurt. So now I'm going to get back. It's so easy to get back at people. You know, it's so simple today to share something negative about another person, and that's going to somehow vindicate, you know, the hurt that I experienced, and therefore now I have the right to do this. I mean, it's just so pertinent and relevant to every part of our lives. I'm just going in circles here until somebody saves me. Anybody has any questions or comments? I've shared what I understand as the uniquely Jewish view on speech and not speaking ill of others, and on a more sort of deeper psychological and metaphysical level, what's really happening when we speak ill of one another. I thank you guys for listening. Any questions or comments, please? Yes, Sajid.
Well, once the point is of a person's a public figure, then even if you say something that's false, you still don't have slander because they have a higher threshold that's malice. But the other question, the thing that's a question is that metaphysically speaking, for example, in American jurisprudence, if someone's dead, there is no cause of action for slander or defamation, whereas in Judaism, there is still a slander or defamation after.
That's correct.
So with that being said, and I'm more of a metaphysical level, the Bible, right, where it has stories about, you know, Moses and Aaron and so on and so forth, if a person looks at the Bible in a negative way, essentially they're creating also that potential for slander on the Bible. So how do you reconcile the paradox?
Well, I think it's important. These stories in the Bible are not there, you know, for us to beat up biblical personalities. On the other hand, I don't believe that everything that's mentioned in the Bible, we're supposed to just whitewash and justify every action. Right, we're talking now about Jacob, who deceived his father Isaac in order to receive the blessings. We're talking about this Dispatch Shabbat. I don't necessarily believe that that's in there so we can figure out an explanation for what Yaakov did. Yaakov may have made a mistake. And that's maybe why it's in there, to be able to learn from. One of the great Jewish philosophers, Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, taught this, that we don't believe in the infallibility of man, of people. Even biblical characters like Moses sinned and made mistakes. We're supposed to learn from them, as long as we're not projecting all of our problems and issues on them, and we're being intellectually honest.
No, that's impossible.
Of course. I mean, it is impossible to be perfect, but we try as much as we can to learn from these stories. I mean, why is this whole story in there with Moses and Miriam? It's to teach us that even someone on Miriam was a prophetess. She was an extraordinarily high-level spiritual woman. She was a leader in the Jewish people. She's not a gossiping about people, but she didn't understand about Zipporah and Moshe, and then she tried to. I'm not saying she did it intentionally. I don't know if we do this intentionally when we speak ill of other people. Were you really trying to bring them down so far? Not necessarily. Sometimes. But let's give ourselves benefit now. I'm not sure we do it to bring other people down. But it has the effect of taking away that which is unique and distinct about the other person.
Right. There's something actually that almost, it definitely is in all three categories. It almost creates its own category. As far as politics is concerned, that's happened this time around. You guys probably saw this in the news. False news. Now, what that means is, I don't know if some of that we're working on, I would get to see this thing. People are actually writing their own stories. They created a news service. They're writing their own stories, making everything up. And it wound up on certain websites, like the politicians' websites, as like, they didn't check it out at all. They just put it up there because it was helping their cause, their side of the equation. I don't know if you guys heard this. It's wild.
So I remember last week Atara mentioned what was it called?
The echo chamber,
but it was a word before the echo chamber, where people were sort of blocking,
unfriending each other,
so that opposing points of view never get to your page. Listen, blatantly making stuff up obviously is a problem.
And then not checking.
You know, we also had a big fact-checking issue in the debates as well. I really think we need a real referee. Chris Wallace, I think I would vote for Chris Wallace. Because he was the only one of the moderators of all the three debates that kept, to some degree, the candidates on point. And every time they started getting personal, he pulled them right back to the issue. You could, I don't know how you would do this so quickly, but you could have a referee with a fact checker, that anytime somebody says something that has no credible basis, it's not allowed in. I have to, if we're getting to that place, I don't know if we're that far gone, I don't know. Any other questions? Yeah, Tara.
I don't know if you mentioned it, but you talk about when it is okay to say Lashon Hara.
So I mentioned one example. We spoke about if someone is privy to a business arrangement and someone's going into business. The other one is a little grayer, and I want you to hear this with caution. And that is when we date. Can you fully disclose and share with other individuals negative information about someone you might have dated if they're asking you for your opinion of them? What do you do? So this is very important. It needs to be firsthand and needs to be objective. Objective and firsthand. Just because you don't like someone doesn't give you license to badmouth them to someone else who might be interested in dating them. It's a real quick and easy way of getting back at them, but it's inappropriate and it's definitely in violation of one of these three categories. However, if someone, certain red flags that you saw, that you experienced firsthand, and they are objective things, they're not simply your opinion, then you have a responsibility to actually share them. If they involve some form of danger or abuse, then you must say something.
And as a rabbi, I will tell you, we often keep quiet when we should speak up, and we speak up when we should keep quiet. We are very challenged in this area. I've been involved in situations, but if you know material information that is objectively verifiable and negative, and it is important for the other person to know, then you have a responsibility to share that with the other individual. But you might want to check with a third party to make sure that you're not simply being vindictive or, make yourself feel a little better because you were hurt. It's hard to tell sometimes. But those are the two main exceptions to the rule of Lashon Hara, dating and business. Again, it's not all business, and it's not all dating issues. It's a very, very specific and narrow exception, but it's a real exception to the rule. If you're unsure if you should say something about someone else, I would always err on the side of not, but you can ask a question. You can call a rabbi and say, Joe, Schmo, A and B, and what do I do? Because there's a whole rule book on this in Jewish tradition. It's very, very important. Yes?
Rabbi, you were alluding to before how speech is the most direct form of communication, both interpersonally and now there have been no sacrifices with God. I mean, the Ten Commandments touches upon not bearing false witness. As Lashon Hara is so important, any thoughts as to why it doesn't just directly
why is Lashon Hara in the Ten Commandments? So let me tell you one thing about Ten Commandments, really important. A lot of really important stuff's not in the Ten Commandments. The other 603 commandments are just as important, we believe, in the Ten Commandments. The great medieval sage Sajagon went to great lengths to demonstrate that the Ten Commandments were actually not 10 mitzvot, but 10 dibrot, utterances under which the other 603 fall. He went through all 613 and showed how every mitzvah falls under one of these 10 categories. I don't know where Lashon Hara falls, but I'm sure probably, you mentioned not to take God's name in vain or not to bear false witness. I'm sure it's in one of those. So the fact that it's not in the Ten Commandments doesn't necessarily mean it's any less important. There's so many other important examples of things that we take very, very seriously that are not in there explicitly, but they may be subsumed. They may be subsumed. That's a good question. Any other comments? Any other questions? Does anybody want to say anything negative about the teacher, the class? Badmouth me. Well, how did it go tonight? Let me ask you one little question. Do you think this is doable? Can we do this? Or is this just too radical? Is it just too part of who we are and the way our society works for us to... can a comedian get up without actually bad-mouthing another person? I used to really think that Jerry Seinfeld was so brilliant because he could actually make a lot of people laugh without actually taking a person and just ripping them apart or using four-letter words every 2 seconds. I really do believe that that is if you're able to actually make people laugh without hurting anyone else, that's a higher level comedian. And there is a place. The Talmud speaks about comedians that they serve a very important function. They do. To make people laugh, to put a smile on another person's face and help them deal with their reality is an extraordinarily important thing. But can't we figure out a way of doing that? Should have like clubs, or they have like Lashon Hara free comedy clubs. Would anyone come? Could anyone? Yeah, Tara.
Sometimes it happens like that the conversation steers around talking about somebody, and you could kind of feel uncomfortable. And like the two options is to... One is you're going to end up embarrassing the person who's being killed, right. The other by being like, that's not nice. Or you could change the subject, or you could defend the person.
Right.
What's the best way of... making the situation better without making the person.
Right. So if you, first of all, if you can walk away without embarrassing someone else, I was once having a conversation with someone, and then one guy just went into this whole tirade about some other guy. And then the third guy was like, whoa, this is Lashon Hara, I'm out of here. And he darts off, and I was like standing there. Oh, this is awkward. Now, it takes two to tango. So if you don't listen to it, it can't be spoken, you see. Like, the, you know, if a tree falls in the forest, there's no one there to hear it. Did it make a sound? If there's no one to hear the Lashon Hara, then, you know, that's... And so we're as guilty listening to it as we are speaking about it. So if you can duck away without really humiliating the other person, then that's the best thing. If you can't, I think the second best thing would be to change the subject or somehow, yeah, change the subject. Because defending, it doesn't stop the conversation. It doesn't stop the conversation. It can often make it worse. And that is an awkward type of thing if you're at work and people are talking about a specific individual. If you're at a social event, you're at the Kiddush at MGE, and somebody's name comes up. This is why, by the way, and I'm guilty of this, you know, the Talmud says, not the Talmud, but in the book that the Chofetz Chaim wrote, I'm going to finish in a minute, it's called Shmirat HaLashon, which is a whole book about the laws and rules of Lashon Hara. He said you're not even supposed to say nice things about another person. Now, why can't you say anything nice about another person? So I've seen this too many times, where I say something nice about someone, they're like, yeah, he's a jerk. Really? Yeah, but he... And then all of a sudden it goes the other way. So look, if... I don't know, it's hard. It's very tricky. It's really, really tricky. You do the best you can, obviously. A lot of it is awareness and sensitivity. If we could somehow become more aware and think a little more before we speak, everything is so fast today. And our thoughts are not well prepared. And we just sort of shoot from the hip. And we get a quick laugh, but at the end of the day, people get hurt. It gives us this false sense of growth. It's just not worth it in the end. But we're not thinking that far. We're just trying to get by through our day. So the best thing would be to get out of there or change the subject somehow. What was that quote? Maybe we'll end with this. They say that small people...
Right.
Help me out with this. Small people talk about...
Small people?
People?
Medium
people talk about...
Just
things...
Yeah, and the great minds talk about ideas.
Ideas, great people, great minds talk about... I don't know, we just killed that whole quote. It's really, but it's... you know what I'm saying? It's like, if we could try... It's just so much more fun, let's face it. Elections are more fun to personalize, and it's more fun to... But it's very temporary, it's very fleeting. And I think we could have a much better life if we could be focused on ideas and important things. You can have a good time with that stuff too. And enjoy other people's company without having to take them down in the process. I thank you all for listening and for coming to the series. We are continuing next week with...
Next week we're doing Chanukah workshop.
Oh, come next week. The story your teacher in Hebrew school or your parents never told you about the Chanukah story. We're also going to learn how to pronounce Chanukah correctly. We're all going to become experts in Chaim. No, next week, seriously, it's an amazing story. Come back. We'll be on Facebook Live again. And thank you all for joining tonight. Please stick around. Enjoy some food. Socialize. Talk. Just not about other people.